of all of us organizers and participants to welcome our great friend Dror Barnatan to tell us some words about some very nice formulas. Just very nice formulas for the Alexander Poly.
Okay, good. So, what happened here? Okay, so, instead of reading you the abstract, I read it backwards, which is how I came to the subject. So I actually came to this subject by reading papers by Alexeyev and Torossian on the Kashiwara-Verne problem, completely unrelated. I realized it had some diagrammatics that had to do with wheels and trees underlying it. I later realized that really they were constructing a universal finite type invariant of a certain class of objects. I went on and studied these objects, and I wanted to do computations, and to the it was quite hard, so I had to look for a meaningful quotient in which to do the computations. And the talk is mostly about that quotient, which is more or less the Alexander polynomial, but with some, what I think, are new and nice formulas about the Alexander polynomial. But again, the talk will be organized in the opposite order. So the talk will follow a handout, only the first two pages of what I've given you. The rest is a show-off. Now, if you don't have a copy, you can pick up a copy from here. Also, this is the main thing you have to understand. You don't have to memorize it, okay? There are formulas here that I don't remember myself, but still this is the key to the talk, okay? But before that, the talk is mostly or partially about tangles, so let me tell you what I mean by tangles. So a tangle is a thing like that. So a picture of a knot inside a partial disk or something, but it may have end points. So you see, this is not connected. This is a genuine gap, okay? And so it may have endpoints, and I'm not insisting that the endpoints will come in any particular order, okay? So it's not necessarily within a box with an up and down piece or anything like that. It's on a disk, and I don't insist anything about the ordering. However, the components are labeled. So this one is labeled B, this one is labeled R, this one is labeled G. And mostly, I will insist that there will be no closed components, even though it is not major. It just makes my life simpler. Okay? Now, there are two operations that I care about tangles. There are a few more, but there are two that I want to show now. Okay, one is the disjoint union. So if you have two tangles, T and S, you can just put them side by side, making no connections whatsoever. Okay? And the other is the stitching operation. So if you have a tangle T with ends A and B, or more precisely with strands A and B, A will come out somewhere and B will come out somewhere, but the strands are all like, so A is pointing out and B is pointing in here. The operation of stitching is to connect the end of A to the end of B, to the beginning of B, and calling the resulting thing C. Okay? I will call this MAB sub C. And note that this operation satisfies a minor property called meta-associativity. So if you started with T that had three strands, A, B, and C, then stitching A to B calling the result A, then stitching A to C calling the result again A, is just stitching A, B, and C together calling the result A. So that's the same as stitching B and C calling the result B, and then stitching the A and B and calling the result A. Okay, so that, I think it's obvious, but I still want to note this property. By the way, this double slash means little circle done right. So it's composition, but you do things in the order you read them instead of the opposite order.
Excuse me, but I can't imagine how you can stitch an end which is not free after you stitch A and B.
No. I stitch A and B, call the result A.
But it
sticks out somewhere else. It goes out somewhere else. So here's a typical picture. you have, well, here are A, B, and C, and they are oriented up, down, up. So you stitch A to B, and then the resulting thing you stitch to C. The result is you just stitched all together, all three, and you could have done it in the opposite order. I could have done this first and then that. It's trivial, completely, absolutely. There's nothing here. Okay?
Do you do that only for the adjacent endpoints?
At the moment, I do it only for adjacent. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense. But very soon, I will relax this. In fact, it's wrong to do it just for adjacent. Okay? Anyway, why do I care about tangles? So, first of all, they are finitely presented. With these two operations, and the generators being the empty strand, the overcrossing and the undercrossing, things are oriented, so there is a difference between the two. Well, if you want to generate an arbitrary tangle, you just use the first operation to put a good number of copies of these in the plane, then you stitch their ends together, and you got the tangle you wanted. And likewise, so this means that it's finitely generated, and it's finitely presented, the relations being the Rademeister moves written using these operations. Okay? Next, tangles are lovely, because you can divide and conquer proofs and computations. So what it means, for example, you know, often you want to compute a complicated knot invariant, and it takes an exponential amount of computations. So you need to do 2 to the n operations if you have n crossings. You cut the knot in 2, in each side you have n over 2 crossings. So you need 2 to the n over 2 on each side, and twice 2 to the n over 2 is a lot less than 2 to the n. So if you have an invariant of tangles that is well behaved under these operations, it often leads to simplified computations and also simplified proofs, because if you want to prove something which is local, for example, invariants under Rademeister 3, well, you just have to, you can concentrate your attention on the part that you want to look at. You don't have to look at the rest of the knot. Next, there's something called algebraic knot theory, which I want to advertise, and it's the following. So maybe I'll give an example. Here is a definition of ribbon knots. If you don't know what ribbon knots are from before, tune out for a few seconds. I'm sorry, I'm not going to define ribbon knots right now. But anyway, so a ribbon knot is a knot T, a knot K, for which there exists a tangle T, such that A, if you cap the tangle, so it's a tangle with 4 components and connectivity as shown by the dashed lines, and with the properties that if you cap the 4 components as shown so as to get a 2-component tangle, it is the trivial 2-component tangle. So that's a property that I want from T. If T satisfies this, then if you stitch the 4 strands of T as shown here, the result will be a ribbon knot, and furthermore, all ribbon knots arise this way, well, except instead of 4, you may need 6 strands or 8 or an even number of strands. Now, if you don't believe me, you can entertain yourself by looking at this example. This example, when this end and that end are stitched, and this end and that end are stitched, so when you do the operation on the left, you get a trivial tangle. It's fun to try to follow it, okay? And if you do the other stitching, you can check that you get the connect sum of a trefoil with its mirror, which is a ribbon knot. Okay? So this means that if you know tangles and know the operations I mentioned, you have an algebraic definition of ribbon. And this means that if you have an invariant which respects these operations, it will give you an algebraic constraint on ribbonness. Namely, a knot is ribbon. If a knot is ribbon, then its invariant Z of K will belong to all second closures of Z, where Z is a potential value for the invariant, and second closure mean apply this operation, provided the first closure of Z is 1, is the invariant of the untangle. Okay? So if you have a knot K and you compute its Z and it doesn't follow, it doesn't fall within this set, you know it's not ribbon. Okay? Likewise, there are algebraic definitions of genus and crossing numbers. So if you have well-behaved invariant of tangles, you have handles on these properties. Handles with which you can manipulate these properties. Whether you will get something or not will depend on the power of your invariant. Okay? The theorem. So far I just told you why I like tangles, now the theorem. So the theorem says, okay, first of all, I'm talking about S component, so tangles with S components. S is a set, so what I mean is tangles whose components are labeled by the elements of a set S. I want them to be pure, so I'm not allowing closed components, but again, it's not terribly important. And I want them to be framed, so I don't want to bother with modding out or checking Rademeister 1. Okay? And given a set S, I define a ring R to be the ring of rational functions in S variables called T sub A, where A is in the set S. Okay? And then I claim that there is a unique invariant gamma with domain the set of tangles I mentioned before and target the ring R times S by S matrices over the ring R. So S by S matrices just means matrices whose rows and columns are labeled by the elements of S. So basically, if S has n elements, it will be n by n matrices, but I also insist on labeling the rows and the columns in the same way as S. Okay? So by the way, the way I would represent such a matrix is by a picture like this. So I will put, the way I will represent the target space of the invariant is by a picture like this. So the matrix part is over here. It has rows A, B, and then, columns A, B, and then the rest of S. And rows A and B, and then the rest of S. And it has a single additional element, omega, which corresponds to this R, and these alpha, beta, and omega are elements of the ring. Okay? Now I haven't yet finished stating the theorem. The theorem is that there is a unique invariant intertwining the following operation. So the operation corresponding to disjoint union, so if you have omega 1, A 1, where A is a matrix, and omega 2, A2, and you want to take the disjoint union, you will multiply the omegas, you will multiply the scalars, and take the block diagonal sum of the matrices. So that's what corresponds to the disjoint union of tangles. And the operation corresponding to stitching is as follows. So you have a tangle, you want to stitch ends A and B. The invariant of that tangle will be a scalar omega along with a matrix, which is of the form, well, it has a column A, a column B, a row A, a row B, and then the entry at the AA position I'll call alpha, the entry at the AB position I'll call beta. Theta is a row of further entries. And you can tell it's a row because it has a horizontal line in the middle. And epsilon is likewise an entire row of further entries, and again it has a horizontal row in the middle, so you can tell it's a row. And phi and psi are the columns that I'm not mentioning, and they have vertical rows. And then chi is an n minus 2 by n minus 2 matrix, and you can tell it's a matrix because it's big. Okay? And now I have to tell you how the stitching operation acts. So if I want to stitch A, B, and call the result C, I'm supposed to get a matrix in which the rows and columns are labeled as before, but with A and B replaced by C. And the matrix is, well, first of all, you define mu to be 1 minus beta. Beta is the entry from here. And the matrix is given by these formulas. So omega gets replaced by mu times omega, gamma gets replaced, the thing that comes in the CC place is gamma plus alpha delta divided by mu. The thing that replaces psi, capital psi, is capital psi plus the row vector theta times the column vector psi, which means that it's a matrix. Divided by the scalar mu, defined over here, so it makes sense to make this addition. The formula makes sense. You're not supposed to remember it. You're only supposed to appreciate that it makes sense. Finally, the result should be in a ring with one less variable, right? Because the result is in a ring with variables in correspondence with the strands of the tangle. So, after you do all of this, every place you see the variable TA or the variable TB, you replace it by T sub C. Okay? And finally, I have to specify the value of this invariant on the generators. And here it is. On the empty strand labeled A, the value is, the scalar is 1 and the matrix is the matrix part is a 1 by 1 identity matrix. On the overcrossing and undercrossing, labeled as here, the values are as written here. So these are, the scalar is 1, the matrices are 2 by 2, and here are their entries. Okay? Now, what's the content of the theorem? Well, first of all, the uniqueness of the invariant follows from the fact that the space is finitely generated. The space of tangles is finitely generated. Since I've specified the invariant on the generators and I told you how the operations act, the invariant is fully specified. The existence just means that this satisfies all the relations, meaning the Rademeister moves. I'll check it in a minute, okay? But before that, I want to tell you a few things about why I'm happy about this invariant. Now, you know, one obvious reason why not to be happy is that it completely lacks interpretation. I just gave you random formulas, okay? What appears to be random formulas. Well, the formulas came from somewhere. They're not entirely random, okay? But you see, even with no interpretation, it's still a good invariant, so let me explain. Oh, actually, the first comment is about an interpretation. So really, all that the formulas do is that this is a stitching formula for an invariant considered previously by Ledimet, Kirk, Livingstone, Wang, and Simasoni-Turayev. Okay, so really, this is just stitch, sorry. The matrix part is as if the matrix part of what I'm telling you is stitching for a known invariant. I think they've never considered the scalar part of that, and they definitely haven't kind of made it so concise. Okay, second, well, if your tangle is really a one-component tangle, so it's really a long knot, then the invariant will, the omega part of the invariant, the scalar part of the invariant, will be the Alexander polynomial modulo units. Likewise, if your invariant is, if the tangle is, well, if you close a tangle to be a link, by just stitching the end of A to the beginning of A, the end of B to the beginning of B, and so on, then the multivariable Alexander polynomial of that link that you will get is very easily computable from the scalar and the matrix that you will get out of the tangle. Now, furthermore, in some sense, this is the fastest Alexander algorithm that I'm aware of. So let's estimate, let's think, how hard is it to compute the Alexander polynomial of a knot using this? The formulas are complicated, but they're actually extremely easy. If you look at these formulas, the stitching formula is quadratic in the size of the matrix. All you have to do is, the hardest bit is this theta times phi bit, and theta times psi bit. Or in fact, the hardest bit is to copy entries. So basically, the amount of work is the size of the matrix squared. Now, suppose you wanted to compute a knot, to compute the invariant of a knot, with using this algorithm. Well, you take the knot and you put it in the plane, and you add the crossings in one by one, and each time you add a crossing, you stitch it to all the ones already existing. Now, you will never need to consider more strands than the width of the knot. The width of the knot, if you have an n-crossing knot, typically its width will be square root of n. This is very, very rough, okay? So if you have an n-crossing knot, the biggest matrices you'll have to consider are of size square root of n by square root of n. Each operation, each stitching, will take you square root of n squared operations, so n operations. And how many stitching will you need? Well, you need to stitch n crossings, and each one has like four n's at the most, so it's a constant. So basically, you need n times n operations in order to compute a typical n crossing knot. So it's efficient.
That's when you assume that the polynomial operation is a constant.
Yeah, on the assumption, yeah. What I mean by the word operation is an operation in the ring.
Yeah, so in general, polynomial computation could be slow and the degree gets higher.
Right. In practice, if you are computing the Alexander polynomial, you can identify all the variables in advance instead of having them getting identified as you go. You could identify all of them in advance, and then these are operations in the polynomial ring in one variable, and then you have to pay for that. If you're computing a multivariable Alexander polynomial, then it's operations in a many variable polynomial ring or rational function ring, and this can be much more costly, but still, if you compare it to n by n determinants, n by n determinants are roughly n cubed operations in the ring in the ring that you have. So it's still pretty good. Next, there are also formulas for deleting a strand from a tangle, and from taking a strand and doubling it, replacing it by two parallel strands that do the same thing. I'm not showing you the formulas, but they are of the similar nature to the ones shown over there. Okay? Now...
Excuse me? Yeah. Reversal, you mean to reverse the orientation?
Yeah, reverse the orientation of a strand.
If it interwines with everything else or with other stuff.
Yeah.
Of a full... Not isolated, let's say.
Yeah, yeah, not isolated. Yeah. Anything. Okay. Now, and sort of my favorite observation is that, you know, unlike the usual computation of the Alexander polynomial, you produce a sensible matrix in a completely sensible way. And it's an n by n matrix, roughly. And then you close your eyes for n cubed minutes while your computing is computing the determinant. While you are computing the determinant, the things that you see along the way, the partial matrices that you see along the way, are meaningless. They don't represent anything. So you have to sort of a jump of size n squared from one side of the river, of the pond, to the other side of the pond, and throughout this jump you see things that are meaningless. Throughout this lengthy computation, you see things that are meaningless. Whereas here, the computation is broken into n sort of stepping stones along which you see the invariance of pieces of the knot. So you see invariance of things that actually make topological sense. Now, if you care about, for example, categorification, and you believe that every knot invariant should be, well, not every, but you know, many knot invariants should be categorifiable, then categorifying this big jump, the determinant, is extremely difficult, and we essentially don't know how to do it. However, categorifying simple steps, smaller steps, at the end of each of which, you see the invariant of some actual object, so something that you could expect will have categorification, may well be very easier, but much easier. So that's another reason why I like this. Finally, further, I should say that this invariant extends and in fact is more naturally defined on virtual tangles. So why? Basically, the stitching operation, I had to artificially restrict it to stitching nearby strands. Okay? But in fact, everything works just as well if you allow stitching faraway strands. And if you allow stitching faraway strands, and the stitching will be given by exactly the same formulas, then, first of all, it's more natural, and secondly, the tangles you will get are precisely virtual tangles. Okay? And the last bit that I like about this invariant is that everything fits in one column of the handout, including propaganda, which I already gave you, and implementation, which I'm about to show. So here's the implementation. The key idea for the implementation is that the way you store a matrix is as a quadratic form. So you invent variables T sub A and H sub B corresponding to the rows and the columns of the matrix. And then instead of storing the matrix, you store the quadratic form, which you call lambda, which is sum of alpha AB, the entries of the matrix, times TA HB. And then if you want a specific entry of the matrix, you just differentiate with respect to the relevant TA HB, and that will leave you with the specific, and evaluate the rest at zero, and that will leave you with the entry you wanted. Okay? So, now here's the program. This is the first part of the program. By the way, the program is printed very small because I don't really want you to concentrate on it. Okay, but I do want you to show you that it, you know, it's tiny and it does everything you want. So this is the part that you really shouldn't look at. So it's an even smaller font. This is basically pretty printing. It's so that the results will be printed in the format that I've used before. Nothing here. No math here. Here is the entire math in the program. So, to do the multiplication, which is this disjoint union operation, well, you multiply the omegas and you add the quadratic forms. Adding the quadratic forms exactly corresponds to block diagonal sum of the matrices. And the more exciting is the stitching operation. So to stitch A and B outputting C, you first of all figure out what alpha, beta, theta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and all of these are by taking partial derivatives of lambda. And then you output, and here is the formula taken exactly as it is, I hope, in the handout. If it's different from the formula presented previously in the handout, this is the correct one. Okay, because it runs. Okay? And finally, here is the value of the positive crossing, and the value of the negative crossing is the same as the value of the positive crossing with the variable inverted, replace it by one over itself. Okay? Now, since it's a computer program, it will not run unless you hit enter. So, I hit enter, and let's do some runs. Okay? So, let's check meta-associativity. Without meta-associativity, the computation is not well-defined even on diagrams, not to mention whether it satisfies Rademeister 1 or 2. But you have to check meta-associativity first. So you take a generic matrix with entries as shown here, and you call the result gamma, and then you take gamma and apply to it, multiply 1 and 2 calling the result 1, multiply 1 and 3 calling the result again 1, and ask whether it's equal to gamma to which you apply the other side of meta associativity. You hit enter, and the result is true. The two sides are equal. Meta associativity was verified. That's it. I've just verified it. Now, I could have cheated, I admit. So I could have secretly written a program that always prints true. But I didn't. Okay, and believe me, I've run it many times, and often it prints false when
so
I make a mistake.
What are you running it in?
Mathematica.
Okay.
Okay? Next, let's prove Rademeister 3. Rademeister 2 is even easier. So here are the two sides of Rademeister 3, written as tangles. Now, let's mark the strands that make up the crossings with numbers 1 to 6. So the strands that make up these crossings are labeled 1 and 6. The strands that make up these crossings are labeled 2 and 4. So if I wanted to compute the invariant of this, I will have to take a positive or negative, I don't know which one it is, crossing with 2 and 4. So that must be this one. Okay? And then a positive or negative crossings of 6 and 1. So this must be this one. And then I need to stitch 1 to 4. So I stitch 1 to 4, calling the result 1. I stitch 2 to 5, calling the result 2, and so on. I hit enter. This time, I didn't ask the computer to check equality, but to print the result. So I hit enter, and the results get printed, and you can. So the results are 3x3 matrices because these are 3 component tangles, with an additional scalar at the top, which is 1 in both cases, and the 3x3 matrices are the same. Rademeister 1, Rademeister 3 is now proven. Okay, genuinely proven. Okay. And this is sort of an example of divide and conquer, by the way, because sort of in order to prove Rademeister 3, I just had to concentrate on the neighborhood of Rademeister 3. And then the final running example is my favorite 8 crossing knot, 817. So again, I label the crossings, the strands at the crossings, 1 to 16. So like this crossing is a crossing of 10 and 15. So I tell you, where is it? It's here. It's a positive crossing where 10 goes over 15. I multiply all the symbols corresponding to the crossings, which just means that I take the disjoint union of 8 crossings spaced far away from each other. And then I call the result gamma. Then I do stitching. So I iterate as k goes from 2 to 16, stitching 1 and k, putting the result in 1. So I first stitch 1 to 2, putting the result in 1. Then I stitch, meaning naming the result 1. Then I stitch 1 and 3, naming the result again 1, and so on. So at the end I've stitched everything, and I should be getting the invariant of the knot 817. I hit enter, and it prints out the Alexander polynomial of 817. Notice how fast it was, by the way. I mean, the moment I hit enter, the results appear. Sorry, now I'm kidding you. But
you have to write out all that top row with all those things and then stitch the right ones to each other.
Yeah, but that's linear. That's linear amount of work. It's human labor. It can be automated, of course, but it's not. It's nothing. You draw your favorite knot, you number the things, and you... It's easy. Okay? Now, but let's go on. Okay? So, I also have a few weaknesses. So, you know, I told you why I like this invariant, but a few weaknesses include... Well, one is sort of not terribly important, but the stitching operation is non-linear. So, it means that if you want to verify an identity, it's very easy. If you want to check the double delta move, whatever it is, which says that the invariant before double delta is equal to the invariant of after double delta, it's easy. You just compute the invariant of one side, compute the invariant of the other side, they come out equal. The two tangles that appear on the two sides give the same invariant. However, if you want to prove a stain relation, this is not very suitable. I mean, if you want to prove something like overcrossing minus undercrossing is equal to z times the smoothing, that's not excellent, because you lose linearity. Okay? Because it's not well behaved relative to linear conditions. Okay, the second point is actually much more significant. So, you see, when I started, I told you that the entries are rational functions. So, they have numerator and denominator. From the perspective of computations, it doesn't matter very much. From the perspective of categorification, well, people have no idea, or we don't know how to categorify rational functions. It doesn't quite make sense. So, but the end result, if you compute the Alexander polynomial, the end result is a Laurent polynomial. So there should be a way to see that it's a Laurent polynomial throughout. And indeed, I can show that if you take the matrix part A and multiply it by the scalar part omega, you always get a Laurent matrix. You get a matrix of Laurent polynomials. So in fact, omega, the scalar part, is really the denominator of all the entries in the matrix. In the matrix. Okay? However, the proof that omega times A is a Laurent polynomial, well, you prove it by induction. You have to assume that it's a Laurent polynomial before doing a stitching operation, and then you have to show that stitching preserves this property. But stitching doesn't preserve this property. In order to prove this property, you have to make a certain assumption on the minors of the matrix. And it turns out that the matrix has, well, an n by n matrix has a 2 to the n minor, well, 4 to the n minors. So, how many? 2 to the n choose n, sorry, 2n choose n. But anyway, exponentially many minors. So if you want to prove that everything remains a Laurent polynomial throughout, you actually need exponentially many, you have to take care of exponentially many conditions and show that they, you know, the exponentially many conditions before stitching imply exponentially many conditions after stitching. So, if ever this will be categorified, I expect that the argument why it is Laurent will have to be categorified as well, and the end result will still take an exponential amount of time to compute. So the categorification should be much harder than the invariant itself. Is this okay? Are you okay? Are you with me? So this is the end of what I had to say about very good formulas for the Alexander polynomial. Now I wanted to tell you where they came from. So now I'm going backwards in time a bit. Is this okay? Okay, so in fact, the story started from four dimensions, and well, it started in a different way in four dimensions, but I'm presenting the way that's now I understand best. So really, instead of looking at invariant of tangles, I am looking at invariants of simply knotted balloons and hoops, and I have to explain what this is. So, first of all, these things live in R4 or S4, I don't care which. Second, balloons are two-dimensional spheres oriented and labeled by elements U and V and maybe W, which are all elements of a certain set T, where T is just the set of balloons, and hoops are S, sorry, and I should have said that the balloons are all attached to some base point, which typically I will take to be infinity, but they are all attached to a base point by a string. Okay? Hoops are one-dimensional circles also attached to that base point by a string. Okay? And they are also oriented and labeled by the elements x, y, and z, or maybe more, of some set H. The set KBH of H and T will be the set of all ways of knotting such a thing in R4 in a simple way. So what is simply knotted? Simply knotted means, so something in R4 is simply knotted if you can project it to R3. Now when you project it to R3, embeddings become singular, I mean things cross. Now typically when you have two-dimensional things in R3, they cross in lines, but occasionally three of them may cross in one point. Right? Three planes generically will intersect. So a simply knotted KBH, knotted balloon and hoop, is a KBH in which the balloons have, when projected to R3, have only double points. No triple points, and if you know what they are, also no branch points. Okay? Now, by an old theorem, this is equivalent to being ribbon. But ribbon, but not in the sense of before, but one-dimensional. Okay? But you don't need to know what ribbon is. You just need to know relatively simply, you know, having relatively simple-minded projections. Let me give you a few examples. So, first example is the unknotted hoop, I don't know, epsilon x. The unknotted hoop labeled x going from minus infinity to infinity, not terribly interesting. Second example is this thing, and this thing actually represents a balloon, so let me explain how. It looks like a kind of a ping pong racket, right? It has a handle and a rim and a net. So to make a balloon out of it, you take the net, you make two copies of it, and you put them parallel with sharing the rim, and you take one copy and you lift it up in the T direction, not in the Z direction, in the T direction. And then you take the other copy and you push it down in the T direction while keeping the rim in the same place. The result is a balloon whose projection to R3 is the exact same ping pong racket as before. But you know, if you were to look at it with the three coordinates being x, y, and t, if you were to look at it in R3 with the three coordinates being x, y, and t, it would look like this. Okay? Next example. So this is sort of the analog of the Hopflink. So you take a tennis racket, and you let a hoop pierce through it. Now, the rule is that things are drawn in R3, and only the pink stuff gets pushed to R4. So this, well, when drawn in R3, looks singular because the hoop intersects the net of the racket. But remember that the net gets pushed up and down to t greater than 0 and t smaller than 0. So in R4, there is really no singularity here. And this is essentially a Hopflink, an analog of the Hopflink, where one side is two-dimensional and the other side is one-dimensional. And likewise, there is the negative hoplink. These four things taken together, I will call the generators, for a reason which you can imagine, and for a reason which will be obvious in a minute. Okay? So far, these are kind of silly examples. Here is a nice example, and essentially, it's a construction which is due to Shin Sato, but I learned it from Lou Kaufman in Siegen in 2001, and here it is. So, here is a picture of a KBH with two hoops. Well, one hoop is this blue thing starting here and ending here, so starting at infinity and going to infinity. The other one is more complicated, it goes like this. And it also has two balloons. Both look like sort of the, you know, sausage balloons, you know, the ones you make sort of toy dogs for your kids from. You know what I mean? Like longish. Anyway, so here is one balloon, this pink thing that goes around, and it's connected to infinity by a string. And the other one is simpler. Okay? Now, this is a picture in R3. But it is to be interpreted in R4 just as before. So wherever you see a pink thing, you double it, you keep the rim in place, but you take one copy and lift it up a bit to in the T direction, and another copy down in the T direction. And the amount you push is proportional to the distance from the boundary. So this, so you know, near the boundary you push only a little, and near the middle you push a lot. Okay? Now, there are apparent singularities like here, but of course this isn't a singularity. And what's more interesting is that this isn't the singularity either, because this piece of the net is wider than this piece of the net, so it gets pushed more. So there is no singularity in R4 between this piece of balloon and this piece of balloon. Okay? Note also that I didn't even bother to specify which side here is over and which side is under, because it doesn't matter. In R4, if you have hoops, or if you have one-dimensional things, they cannot be noted. There is no difference between over and under. Okay? So this is some specific KBH in R4, with two balloons and two hoops. Now, here is the Sato construction. This KBH is associated in an obvious way to this tangle. Namely, given a tangle, you just interpret its end points as being a play. Well, okay, sorry. You first of all make two copies of the tangle, and you draw one of them in blue, and the second one you thicken a little bit and draw it in pink. Okay? Then the end points you interpret as connections of the balloon to infinity. The beginning points you interpret as a capping of the balloon and a connection of the hoop back to infinity. And the crossings you interpret as shown here. And you can check that this is a well-defined map from tangles, even modular randomized tangles, to knotted balloons and hoops, modulo isotopies. So, if I will produce an invariant of KBHs, I will in particular produce an invariant of tangles.
Is it one-to-one or onto or both?
Sorry?
Is the map one-to-one or onto or?
The map is injective, and it is obviously not surjective, because, the sort of the components here are paired, there is an equal number of balloons and hoops, okay? But it actually becomes surjective if you allow to puncture balloons so that they pop and disappear, and cut hoops. So they, in other words, if you allow deleting components. So if you want to get an arbitrary KBH, you can start with a tangle with a few more components, and then drop a few of the components after applying delta. So it's essentially onto. Okay? But the kernel is not well understood. Sorry, not the kernel. The No. Sorry. Forget it. It's as I said. The kernel comes later, not now. Sorry. Okay. Now, the point about these KBHs is that they also have a set of lovely operations. Okay? You know, this workshop is about algebraic structures, right, in knot theory. I have to give you an algebraic structure that sort of is built out of knots, okay? So I'm cheating and talking about two-dimensional knots in R4. This isn't really knot theory, but at least there should be an algebraic structure. Okay? So here's the algebraic structure. Well, okay, there are punctures and cuts, I won't say anything about them. If you have two KBHs, there is a naturally connected sum operation where you just embed the two next to each other and make them share the base point. And then come the interesting operations. And the interesting operations, the way to remember them is to remember that it's just like pi 1 and pi 2 of a topological space. So if you have a topological space, pi 1, well, it's measured by circles, right? And it's a group. Pi 2 is measured by balloons, and it's a group as well, in fact, abelian group. And furthermore, pi 1 acts on pi 2. So similarly, now the space is R4, and we're talking about embeddings rather than maps, okay? Rather than homotopy class of maps, it's isotopy classes of embeddings. But the operations are more or less the same. So if you have a KBH K with balloons labeled U and V and hoops labeled X and Y, the tail multiplication is like multiplication in pi 2. So you basically connect the two balloons together by building a tunnel in between them along the strings that connected them to the base point. Okay? The head multiply operation, so or hoop multiply if you wish, it's the parallel of the multiplication of pi 1. So you trace along x and then along y and call the resulting thing z. So you trace along x and then along y and call the resulting thing z. And then finally, the last operation, the tail by head action, whatever, of tail u by head x, it's really like the action of pi 1 on pi 2. So you take one of the balloons and you reroute its string along one of the hoops, which of course could be knotted, right? So in fact, the picture here summarizes two of the operations. So if you have a heart-shaped balloon, then the two lobes somehow correspond to the multiplication in pi 2, and sort of the action of pi 1 on pi 2 is what you do before you give the balloon to your kid, right? You tie the, what do you call it? The nozzle? The end. Okay? One more definition before I can state the theorem. So if you have a KBH, LXU is the linking number of hoop X with balloon U. So basically you count how many times the hoop X passes through the balloon U. It makes sense, it's just like the ordinary linking number, one dimension down. And then define for a given KBH, define sigma sub X, where X is a hoop. Define it to be, well, some sort of generating function of the linking numbers of that particular x. So it's the product over all balloons of the variable corresponding to that balloon raised to the power, the linking number of that balloon with our hoop x. Okay? So this assigns to each hoop, to each one-dimensional thing, it assigns an element in the ring of rational functions, but in fact it's a monomial, okay? It's in a big ring, but it's just a single monomial, in the ring of rational functions in variables that correspond to the two-dimensional balloons, okay? Now, this is completely minor to compute, completely linear time. Ignore it. It's just nothing. Okay? But without it, the theorem isn't true. So, theorem two, there is a unique invariant of KBHs into scalars cross T by H matrices. And now I have to tell you how the operations behave. Okay? So, and then I have to tell you where the generators go. So, the operations are disjoint union becomes like before, except now these are not square matrices, but rectangular matrices. Tail multiply is something, head multiply is something, the last one is another formula. What the formulas are is not so interesting. What is interesting is that you get an invariant. Okay? And in a minute I will tell you a little bit more about where it comes from. And finally, I have to tell you where the generators go. And they go here. They go to these values. I still have 4 minutes and 20 seconds. I clicked at the beginning. I know exactly when I started.
You said you get an hour.
So,
the chairman's voice.
Finally, so, okay, how do you check that this is an invariant? One way to check is to... I lie a bit, but one way to check is to implement it and run the program just as before, check the moves, it works. Okay? Maybe later I will tell you where I lied a little bit. Okay. And finally, if T is an ordinary tangle, then the beta invariant, so the invariant just defined here, of delta of T, delta is the Sato map, the result is an omega times a matrix. And the claim is that the gamma invariant, where gamma is the invariant of tangles, is the matrix, the scalar is the same scalar, and the matrix is the matrix A modified by something very easy along the diagonal. So it's essentially the same invariant. Okay? And furthermore, under this correspondence, if you want to compute stitching operation of tangles, it corresponds to a certain composition of all three operations here of balloons and hoops. So you can say, well, it's more complicated. In fact, it's much more simpler. It's much simpler. Because really what I've done is I've broken a complicated thing into three pieces, each of which already has a topological interpretation. So in the language of stepping stones of before, I've inserted three further stepping stones in between, or two further stepping stones in between each two of before. Okay? I think I don't want to tell you about the lie that I just told you, but I want to tell you about theorem 3. So where did beta come from? Where did this invariant beta come from? So it came from a unique invariant, zeta, which in itself is the logarithm in some sense of an invariant z, where z has a completely canonical definition. It's the unique homomorphic universal finite type invariant of the objects in its domain. So I'm running out of time, now I admit it, so I will not even define finite type invariants, but if you know the definition of finite type invariants, there is an associated canonical notion of universal finite type invariant. The universal finite type invariant of not a balloon and hoop, by a computation similar to the way chord diagrams arise in ordinary finite type invariants, becomes an invariant with values in the freely algebra in T generators raised to the power H times cyclic words in T generators, whatever. These can come out to be the analogs of chord diagrams. The notion of a universal finite type invariant which respects the operation is completely canonical, and zeta is defined out of it. Okay? Even that zeta is computable. The formulas are way too hairy to show right now. But had I started with those, you know, if you gave me another hour, I would show you these formulas. They're not that bad. Okay? But the results are completely, you know, here is an actual computation. These are elements of the 3D algebra, so trees, these are elements, these are cyclic words, so wheels. And finally, like in ordinary knot theory, there is a matching, a pairing between core diagrams and Lie algebras. So you can pair the core diagrams, so these trees and wheels, with the two-dimensional Lie algebra. The two-dimensional Lie algebra does not make sense in ordinary knot theory because it doesn't have a metric, but it does make sense over here. And when you do this pairing, there will be relations. You mod out by all the relations, and this is the relation you end up modding out by. And when sort of you mod, when all the dust settles, you get the formulas for beta. So zeta is a completely natural thing. A reasonable reduction of it, and then some manipulating formulas gives you beta, and beta, a reasonable reduction thereof, gives you gamma, or a composition with this Sato map delta gives you gamma, and that's where gamma of the beginning came from. Now I'm running over time by 1 minute. I'll still say it. There is something called the BFT-QFT, and it seems to reproduce zeta. There is a lot more to say about BF and its Feynman diagrams and configuration space integrals, but the bottom line, and the main point is somehow that everything should extend to arbitrary two knots, not just simply knotted two knots. However, there are issues, and now I'm a minute and a half over time, only 30 seconds over time, I can't read. No, a minute and a half over time, so I really have to stop. Okay.
Could you recapitulate how the classical Alexander polynomial fits in all of this? I mean, in particular, how the Fox-Milner theorem for it fits in this?
Fox-Milner is the invariant of the ribbon
on ribbons and slices.
Yes and no. So first of all, how does the Alexander fit? It comes up. So the Alexander invariant is the ordinary Alexander, single variable Alexander. Is just the, if you take a 1-1 tangle, so a tangle with only one, you know, two ends, but one strand, then that's really a knot. And the invariant of such a tangle will be a scalar times a scalar comma a 1-by-1 matrix. The 1-by-1 matrix turns out to be extremely uninteresting. But the scalar is the Alexander polynomial. The scalar meaning scalar in our ring, and it comes out to be the Alexander polynomial. Now, as for the Fox-Milner theorem, so the claim that ought to be true is that when you that the set that you get here, when you use the invariant gamma. So if you compute closures type 2 of all gammas whose closures type 1 is trivial, then you ought to get the other side of Fox-Milner, so polynomials which are sort of squares, or norms, if you wish. Now, the reason I'm saying ought to get is somehow very disappointing. You know, with luck it would have been ready for today. Ask me again at the end of the conference. I have all the ingredients. I think everything will work, but I didn't quite stitch it together.
Yeah, it looked like you were right on time.
I have a question. So you have a characterization of ribbon. Do you have a similar characterization for slice?
Nope. Had it been the same characterization, truly wonderful. But no, I don't have anything like that for slice. That's actually, by the way, I should say that I can prove that there are similar formulas for example, for the Jones polynomial. I don't know what they are yet, okay? But I can prove that they exist. So in principle, there is a handle on finding further constraints on being ribbon. But, okay, principles aside, Even working out the Alexander case, so this story that I told today took me a few years. So, and still, there is still a week to go. Okay? So, you know, it's not clear that you'll get something out of the formulas for Jones that are proven to exist but are not determined yet. Okay?
Could I just comment on the ease of calculation and
yes.
Alexander and things? If you are faced with, certainly if you're faced with something presented as a closed braid, there is a very easily implemented multivariable method for that.
Wrong.
But
wrong in the wrong place. Wrong not where you expect.
Fine.
You're absolutely right. There is a Birao calculus, there is sort of a Gassner representation.
No,
all of
that.
These are trivial.
No.
The problem is completely somewhere else. If you have an n-crossing knot,
yeah.
Typically it will be the closure of a braid with n-squared crossings. The algorithm turns the knot into a braid.
This other one also, it's slightly more awkward to manipulate, but if you've got a thing presented as a flat closure. You're with your cups and cups.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But then your braid is probably a little bit wider.
Yes.
But it's still, you can still use this reduced Birao, very beautiful product of matrices.
Yeah, okay. Now I'm ready to buy.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not sure how it compares.
No. Given the things... I grant you that presenting it as a closed braid is not a nice thing if it isn't there already.
Right.
But when you've got the braid part, even if some of the strings are going up and some are going down, you can
okay.
do nice
now,
things.
Now, frankly, computing the Alexander polynomial is extremely easy, whichever way
yeah.
you look at it.
I'm talking about multivariable.
Multivariable is not so
no,
hard, whichever
you
way you look at it.
Multivariable, this is the place.
So, you know, I agree.
Yeah,
and
no,
let me try to market the other
yeah,
features.
This is another nice thing.
Okay. You know, maybe one thing to market is I don't think anybody has any clue what this colored wheel. So, the trees, I have to admit, are exactly the Milner invariants. There is no information in the trees part except the Milner invariants. But the wheels part is completely new, for all I know.
Any other questions? So let's thank the speaker again.